Time for another chapter in our Science Friday book club. The club regulars are all assembled. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, is here.
Hello.
And Ed Heist, our senior producer.
Hi.
Tell us about, who wants to tell us about what book we're discussing today? Annette, you want to
We are taking a tour of the planets by Deva Sobel.
And that came out in 2005.
2005, right. And we actually, you talked with Deva Sobel in 2006 about this book. And at that time, you asked her why she started the book with a chapter on the sun. The chapter's called Genesis. And this gives a good taste of the book. Here's what she said.
The planets certainly owe everything to the sun. They were all formed at the same time. And that is the creation story that most of us have been told. Scientifically, I don't think they can really be reconciled. But in this book, all links to popular culture were fair game. And I wanted to talk about the planets in ways that would be familiar to people who were not necessarily informed or even interested in astronomy.
And she does talk about, all through the book, about the planets. And we want to invite our listeners, if they have read, hopefully some of them have read The Planets, our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can participate in our book club, Science Friday Book Club, Selection The Planets by Deva Sobel. Came out in 2005. What do you think about the book? Did you like it? Did you not like it? We're very happy to hear from you. Flora, what is it about the book that you found?
That's a non-leading question.
Kiss or diss, Flora?
Ouch, just too much pressure. I think we should explain how the book is set up. So it's entries on every planet and the moon. And I actually like that because you can pick it up, you can dive into one, you can leave. But I also sort of enjoy reading the dictionary from time to time. And that is a little bit what this is like in the sense that, you know, there's no story that connects from one to the next.
Each chapter stands alone.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But there's a lot of poetry. You know, it's not a science. You wouldn't think of it as a quote unquote heavy-handed science book. More as a popularizer of science, I would say.
Sort of a popularizer, although the pop culture elements that are included are not like Train's, you know, song Venus or whatever that song is, but more Van Gogh, Shakespeare. There's poetry by Blake. There's a little bit of Darwin in there.
Highbrow.
It's a potpourri. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Highbrow. Pop culture.
This is Science Friday from NPR.
And the thing about the poetry, I mean, I think, you know, that's a matter of taste kind of thing. So to give you a sense, there's a lot of decorative language in this book. Like, as the stars enriched the heavens that had worn them, the heavens gave rise to new generations of stars. So that you get a sense that they're sort of, you know, if you like that writing style, I feel like maybe I'm a little too geeky. And
not enough details.
Me the science details. That, to me, is compelling. And so I could have had more.
Yeah.
More science, less astrology. I think that was the part of the book that I disliked. The chapter on Jupiter gives us a lot of astrology, which and not enough to actually know any more about how astrology works, just a lot of astrology terminology, and I wasn't particularly interested in that.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry. And you also go to our website at sciencefriday.com and our Facebook page. We're talking about The Planets, a book by best-selling author Deva Sobel, came out in 2005. I think it's a good beginning book.
Yeah.
For people who do not, you know, have a great depth of knowledge about the planets.
Yeah, I think we almost know too much here.
Yeah, I think that might be right. Although I found that there were a lot of interesting little tidbits in it. Like, did you know that every full moon has its own name? So there's not just the harvest moon, there's also the wolf moon and the snow moon and the sap moon and the crow moon. And so I looked up, thank you, Farmer's Almanac, for letting me know when the next full moon is. It's December 28th, and it's the full cold moon. But we can look forward to the full snow moon, I believe, on January 26th.
Yeah, that's something you don't normally pick up, or, you know, hearing that each moon has its own. You hear about the harvest moon, maybe, the blue moon every once in a while.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I liked learning that.
I liked the factoids, too. I'll get in on that. I liked learning where the names of some of the moons came from, Shakespeare, or which parts of mythology the names were borrowed from for other planets. And that song was Drops of Jupiter. I was trying to pull out quickly. Train. Sorry.
But also, the naming, and she talks about the naming conventions changing too, right?
Yes. So
new things are...
Yes, I think there's parts of Mars, I can't remember what page it was on, but now they're named after more common things. Isn't there rye bread?
One of the elements of Mars. Classical Greek mythology, right?
Let's go to the phones, get some comments from Shane in Detroit. Hi, Shane.
Hi, how's it going? Happy holidays, everyone.
You too, thank you.
I was just calling to say that I had the privilege of listening to the planets on a book on tape while driving down to Florida, and I just wanted to say that everyone should read, if not the whole book, the section that talks about the moon, because there's a description of someone consuming a piece of lunar dust. And it was, I mean, I was floored by how emotional and raw it was. And just showing the connection between people and outer space was the most personal thing I've ever read about space. And I just think it's amazing. So I wanted to share that with everyone.
Yeah. People are nodding their heads here with you.
Yes. Yeah, I remember that section too. Also, what would you do with moon dust? Would you eat it? That would never occur to me.
I thought it was insane up until, reviewing that book. But if I did come across a piece of moon dust or ever had the opportunity, I think I would consume it just because of the description in the book, just the celestial overtaking of the tongue and the metallic stinging. I wish that I could experience it.
I had that same reversal. Me too. I thought this was crazy, and then I was sort of sold on it.
The author, David Sobel, set it up like that. At first, you thought she was going to be like, I can't believe you would do that, but then it turns out she's actually jealous. wanted to eat.
You'd think that some astronaut up there on the moon. Thanks for the call, Shane. Happy holidays.
You too.
It must have taken a little bit of dust, right?
Sure.
So what is
absolutely.
This? Wouldn't you want to? You're feeling it in your fingers.
Stuff in your pockets like you're beachcombing.
Put it in your mouth to see what it tastes like. Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about David Sobel's book, The Planets. Give us a call. You can also tweet us your comments. Did you like the book? Have something to say about it? Here with Annette Heist and Flora Lichtman. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back to talk lots more with our Science Friday book club members. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The Science Friday book club is in session. Let me gavel it. Here with me are Flora Lichtman and Annette Heist. We're talking about the 2005 book, The Planets, by David Sobel. And while the book is only 7 years old, lots of stuff about the planets has been written. And since then, there's been news of water ice on Mercury, new moons around Pluto. One, of course, it seems like every week there's something new from Mars rover to tell us something stuff. Pluto's been demoted. Tell us more about what seems like it's like the golden age of planetary discovery is Jim Green. He's the director of the Planetary Science Division at NASA. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Green.
Well, thank you, Ira. It's just a delight to be here.
Tell us, did you read the book?
Actually, I did, not too long after it came out. And what I really liked is that we've heard from a number of people, they like different aspects of it. But I liked the chapter on the Cassini orbit insertion at Saturn. And then Dave was asked by one of the atmospheric scientists, Andy Ingersoll, to come on over and chill with the rest of the scientists. And I think when she went there, she expected that these scientists would be maybe, bookworms, geeks, shy, etc. And what she found out is these were real people, and they exude excitement, and they exude the anticipation of the discoveries that Cassini now would make, and it was a lifelong dream. I mean, many of these people had been working on the project for about 15 years to get it to this point, to get it to Saturn, and now the door was open to make some fabulous observations of a beautiful system with rings and moons and many things to discover. And, of course, that's what's happened over the last several years.
Let us go back in our Wayback Machine a little bit to March 2011. We heard some news about Saturn's moon Titan. Elizabeth Turtle, a research scientist at Johns Hopkins, was on the show to talk about some weird weather on Titan. So it's springtime and it's raining there, but not liquid water rain.
Right, exactly. So it's cold enough that methane is a liquid on Titan. So we see methane in lakes and seas, and those are all concentrated near Titan's poles, and that methane can evaporate up into the atmosphere and condense and form bright methane clouds, which we've been observing and tracking for several years, and apparently rain out onto the surface as well.
Amazing. Wow, there are a lot of different things, Jim. A lot of other stuff has changed then. We found signs of water in a lot of unexpected places, like on the moon and Mercury, and stuff has happened in those 7 years.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the process that we put in place starting in early 2000 was to follow the water at Mars. You know, Mars mm-hmm. looked like it was pretty much moon-like, maybe very arid. And by the time we got our high-resolution camera in place, and by the time we then got down to the surface with Spirit and Opportunity and Sojourner and Phoenix that actually tasted the water, and putting all the clues together, we find that signs of water on the surface of Mars are everywhere. And in fact, we've even seen appears to be briny water leaking out of the sides of craters, flowing down flowing down the sides of the craters before that sublimate evaporates, rather, because it does appear to be liquid at first. And so water is on Mars even today, maybe a significant amount trapped underneath the surface. So we're realizing that the solar system actually is a pretty soggy place.
Dr. Green, will you tell us what's happening with Pluto? People aren't giving up on it being a planet, are they?
No, they're not. But I believe that when New Horizons flies through the Pluto system, it will completely change our understanding of these small objects that exist out beyond Neptune that we call the Kuiper Belt. And these are volatile rich, smaller bodies that are basically a debris left over from the beginning of the collapse of our cloud and the origin of our solar system way back, 4.5 billion years ago. So we're going to find that these, now that, Pluto has got not one moon, Charon, since we launched the spacecraft, but actually five moons, Nix, Hydra, and two others that have been found unnamed. And so there's a process going on right now. Perhaps it's an accretion process where we're actually watching these things coalesce into larger bodies.
You sound like you're still a believer in Pluto. Let me take us back on our way back machine a little bit to Mike Brown, who in 2011, he, of course, is professor of planetary astronomy at Caltech and the author of How I Killed Pluto and Why It Had It Coming. He was on to talk about how Pluto got its planetary status revoked, and he didn't seem to set out to undermine this little ice ball.
I was searching for a 10th planet. I knew that if I found something bigger than Pluto, clearly it had to be a planet. But by the time I got there, by the time I found the object that we now know to be more massive than Pluto, it was really clear that there were so many other things out there that it really made much more sense to step back and call those eight big ones planets, and all these other things that I've been finding are just parts of the Kuiper Belt, cosmic debris.
Jim Green, does that mean that the jury's still out?
No, actually, if I may take 1 second and talk about going way, way back and talk about a time in our science history for which a similar event has occurred. And if we go back to 1850, and we would say how many planets were then you had to memorize in the solar system, you went in the library and you pulled out that physics book and you found that chapter, you'd have to memorize 23 planets. Now, where did all the planets go? Well, many of those were Ceres, Vesta, Juno, Eros, and a whole series of other smaller bodies that we then, by 1852, realized this isn't these aren't planets. These are material that's between Mars and Jupiter. It's a completely different class of objects. We'll call them asteroids. And when they did that, then they dropped from 23 to 8. The same thing is happening, but now in the outer part of our solar system. Pluto is a member of a completely new population of a very, very exciting set of objects that we know not a lot about. But we're about ready, as I mentioned, with New Horizons to find out what's going on out there. Now, as Mike Brown mentioned, he did find many, many out there, and with others in the community looking for these objects well beyond Pluto, we found probably more than 1,000 already, many of which are Pluto size. So we have a lot to learn about our solar system. That's just a completely new population of object, and we call them dwarf planets.
And we've seen other solar systems. We were talking about this just before, other solar systems, exoplanets, that it seems like there may be more of the kind of our kind of solar system around than we thought before.
Absolutely. I mean, we're finding, of course, the first things we start to find are these really big planets, because they're easier to find as they occult the sun and take away their sun and take away more light. And therefore, as that star diminishes in brightness, we can say, oh, that's a giant planet. And from that, we can also get a lot of its orbital characteristics. And what we find is some of these huge planets are on highly elliptical orbits. Others are at orbits that are closer than Mercury is to our sun. And yet we know that those planets couldn't have formed that way. And this has also began to revolutionize our thinking about how planets interact with one another and the potential for those planets to migrate, not only as they gain mass and move inward, but also as they go through gravitational resonances and fight for position, one being thrown out, one being thrown in. And then as they get close to the sun, tidal interactions eventually take these elliptical orbits and make them circular. So it's a fascinating new dimension in understanding origin and evolution of our solar system, because we can also compare with what was going on around other stars.
Well, you don't sound very excited, Dr. Green, about this age we're living in. It is sort of a golden age of planetary exploration, is it not?
It really is, and it's also a confluence of an explosion in social media that is allowing us to share that excitement, to get the word out. You know, Dave's book is really wonderful. I've given it out as gifts, but in reality, it could have stood a revision each and every year and have been more and more exciting as we talk about some of the new discoveries. Now we can do that online.
Yeah.
We've got ebooks. We've got many things to tell our people that fund the NASA program and let them in on what we're finding out.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Green, for sharing your knowledge and your enthusiasm with us today.
And my pleasure.
We'll keep following the continuing saga of Pluto as it unwinds. Dr. Jim Green is director of the Planetary Science Division at NASA.